Greetings, everyone. I want to welcome you to today's Internet seminar on NARPM Presents. This is a series of webinars that are being broadcast as part of the NARPM, National Association of Remedial Project Managers effort. Our title today of our webinar is A Tale of Three Sites, Supporting Reuse Throughout the Cleanup Process. And this is being sponsored by EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Michelle Mahoney, and I am with the Superfund program, and I'll be moderating today's session. We're going to get started in a few moments, but while we wait for others to log on, I want to cover a few housekeeping items. So when you registered, you were directed to the seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We also have some bio sketches and photos of the presenters for you to check out. We also included the presenters' email addresses and their hot links on that page. So if you have any questions after the webinar, feel free to contact any of the speakers. For those of you who are joining on the phone lines, we request that you put your phone on mute for the seminar. We will have a question and answer session after each presentation today. And at that time, we will let you know that you can take yourself on mute to ask a question. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, we ask that you take a moment right now and hit *6, and this will place your phone on mute. When we get to the question and answer period, and if you want to speak up, you will be able to hit #6 to unmute your phone. And I will remind you of this at the question and answer period. By putting us on mute, you'll greatly reduce any background noises that really disrupt the quality of our audio transmission, as we are recording this session for future playback. And please, please, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive during the call. So again, keep us on mute and do not put us on hold. So by now you should all have clicked on the agenda for today to the go-to session icon and be at slide number one of the presentation, which has the title of today's seminar along with the names of the presenters. This is the main page, which contains all the slides, and above the slide you'll see that there are some navigation icons. You can submit questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slide. You don't need to wait to submit a question until the question and answer period. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance of the question and answer session, so when we get there, we're prepared to just start asking the questions of the presenter. If you do experience any technical difficulties with the audio stream, you can also use the question mark icon to alert us of that technical difficulty you are encountering. But please include your phone number where we can reach you so we can help you troubleshoot the problem. Our presenters today will announce when they advance to the next slide. And you may advance with them by clicking to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide, or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. So as I said, we'll have a few question sessions. And at the end of the presentation, we'll walk you through a links page where we have some series of documents, databases, web pages, and other things that are applicable to today's topic. And this information will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. We also have an online feedback form at the end of the presentation, and we ask that you consider filling it out because we do look at the comments as we try to continue to improve the content and delivery of our seminars. So with that, we're ready to start the session. We have three speakers today. The first speaker is Melissa Friedland. She's the Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment and supports the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, which is EPA's effort to return contaminated Superfund sites to productive reuse. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Melissa, who will give a brief presentation. We'll have some questions, and then she can introduce the other speakers.
Great. Next slide.
So now we are on slide number three.
Good afternoon, and welcome to this NARPM webinar. As Michelle said, my name is Melissa Friedland, and I'm the Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment here at EPA headquarters. Frank Avisado and I support the National Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. Today, I'll be presenting with two of our regional Superfund Redevelopment Coordinators, Bill Denman from Region 4 and Fran Costanzi from Region 8. Our goal for this webinar is to share some key EPA tools and approaches for integrating cleanup and reuse in the context of some site-specific efforts. Next slide, please. I'll begin by explaining a bit about Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI as we like to call it, what we've worked on in the past, and some of our earlier successes with Superfund Reuse. As some of you might know, we issued our reuse directive considering reasonably anticipated future land use and reducing barriers to reuse at EPA lead Superfund remedial sites in March 2010, almost exactly a year ago. And this directive provides the regions with guidance on how to think about reuse throughout the pipeline, even post-rod. Today, Fran Castanzi and Bill Denman are going to join me in sharing the stories of three sites that reflect the spirit of the directive. Each of these stories is geared toward working with communities to understand the future uses of sites and doing what we can to make that possible. Next slide, please. At the national and regional levels, Bill and Fran and I, along with a Superfund redevelopment coordinator in each region, are working with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. Reuse is not new. Communities have been reusing cleaned up sites for many years. And even though EPA has always been supportive of site reuse, it wasn't until 1999 that the agency launched the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. So our mission at SRI is to develop tools for site stakeholders to help promote reuse and work with regions to provide site-specific assistance. Next slide. When we began in 1999, we based our efforts on what we termed the four Ps: pilots, promoting reuse, policy reviews, and partnerships. And in 1999, we picked the first 10 Superfund redevelopment pilots, negotiating $100,000 cooperative agreements with local governments that would allow communities to participate more fully in the site cleanup and reuse process. And then in 2002, we selected more pilots, but we also introduced a new approach. We began offering the direct services of a team of land use professionals who are also knowledgeable about Superfund. And soon the team approach became the only way to go. It was simply more efficient and effective. So as I mentioned, we released our reuse guidance in 2010, and throughout our tenure, we've worked to incorporate reuse principles into EPA policy. And as far as promoting reuse, ultimately we found that one of the most effective tools we have is to share the stories of what's been done at other sites. And in order to spread the word about our successes, we developed a lot of communication tools and outreach programs. You'll hear more about these tools and how we learn and apply these techniques across Superfund sites. In 2004, we developed the Return to Use Initiative, which focuses on cleaned up but vacant sites that usually need just a little help from some site reuse, with some site reuse barriers. We'll talk a little bit more about RTU, as we call it, later in the presentation. And since 2004, SRI has established 58 site-specific partnerships called demonstration projects. And these partnerships involve community groups, government officials, site owners, and the parties responsible for cleaning up sites. Next slide.
I want to let everyone know that we're on slide 7.
We have a number of new tools and resources available to help you and to promote general reuse. And I'll be touching on each of these in the upcoming slides. Next slide.
We're on slide 8.
Communication is key. If a site is experiencing successful reuse, we want to make sure others who may be trying to implement reuse at their sites know about it. And as I mentioned before, we found that one of the most effective tools we have is to share the stories of what's been done at other sites. So in order to spread the word, we develop fact sheets, case studies, videos, and brochures, and we continuously update our SRI website with success stories and current information. And in the past year, success stories have been completed for 8 regions. We also have several in-depth comprehensive case studies for anyone interested in understanding how the reuse process played out start to finish. So if you visit our website, you can see stories for HOD Landfill, Aerojet, MDI, and Milltown Reservoir. The Dale flag is in progress, and we'll be looking for other sites to highlight this year. Next page.
Slide 9.
Our website is the hub for most of our tools. We use the website to display successes in the various ways mentioned so far, such as fact sheets and case studies, but we also use it to provide additional information and resources to anyone who might be interested in what we do at SRI. And our SRI videos have become increasingly useful. We post them on our website. We provide them to stakeholders upon request. We use them at trainings. We'll be presenting new videos at the Brownfields Conference next month, including one on Middale's flag, which Fran is going to talk about today. Next slide.
Slide 10.
Through our regional seeds program, we provide startup funding for reuse planning at Superfund sites, and I'd like to take just a minute to explain this process in more detail over the next couple of slides. In the upcoming weeks, we'll be putting this information on our website and providing a few examples of the reports generated through this process. So displayed on the screen are a few of the maps and photographs that were part of the reuse plan for the Bandera Road Superfund site, which is located in the city of Leon Valley in San Antonio. So maps like these are instrumental in determining reasonable future land use. Next slide.
Slide 11.
So to initiate planning projects, SRI provides regional seed startup funds around the country. And through this work, we've seen that well-run community-based reuse planning has the potential to dramatically improve community relations and the public's perception of the agency. It streamlines the remedial process by clarifying a site's reasonably anticipated future land use and integrating that with a site's remedial strategy. And it brings the agency and communities together around more cost-effective remedies that produce the greatest long-term value for local communities. Regional seeds are resources provided by SRI to communities at the request of EPA regional staff. And the seed concept provides an initial investment to bring stakeholders to the table, to clarify remedy constraints, and outline suitable reuse options for the local community to pursue. Additional resources to complete the regional seed process are provided by each region. And as the reuse planning process gains momentum, communities can leverage the initial regional seed investment with local resources to continue the process of returning a local Superfund site to protective use. What SRI has learned is that there is no one-size-fits-all strategy to make reuse happen, and therefore SRI offers several different types of regional seeds to support reuse. Next slide.
Slide 12.
This year, we had a few alternative energy regional seeds where we were able to help sites explore new options for alternative energy with new strategies like pre-feasibility assessments. So the Apache Powder site, which is shown on the screen in Region 9, is a great example. In 2009, SRI provided support to evaluate the suitability of solar energy generation as a reasonable future use of the site, either to power future on-site business operations or sell to the local utility. And efforts are now underway by the site owner to secure a long-term power purchase agreement to produce electricity from a solar photovoltaic array at the site. SRI also began supporting pilot projects in interested regions to explore whether SRI can support green remediation as part of a site's reuse throughout this past year. And based on the outcome of these feasibility pilots, SRI will determine an outreach strategy to share lessons learned and opportunities for interested parties. Next slide.
Slide 13.
Our trainings in 2010 included the annual SRI Coordinators Conference, Green Remediation, SRI University, NARPM, a regional training in Region 7, and quarterly webinars. This year at NARPM, we're planning to provide a panel on the top 5 redevelopment tools, and this session will be presented by me and several other headquarters and regional reuse experts, and we hope will be complimentary to this webinar. We hope you'll join us if you'll be at NARPM this May. Each year, we take the opportunity to collaborate with our regional coordinators, and these annual conferences provide an excellent opportunity to share lessons learned and see what other regions are doing to make things work. In 2011, we'll promote reuse by hosting a display and booth at the Brownfields Conference. Actually, that's next month that I mentioned. And there we hope to highlight some recent reuse successes and experimental techniques, as well as encourage new and exciting reuse efforts among participants from around the nation. The Green Remediation Conference, which was held last summer in June, we supported a presentation on renewable energy, green remediation, and reuse at the Apache Powder Superfund site. And I was fortunate to be down in Region 4 at the Green Remediation Meeting, where I was able to talk about SRI's new green remediation regional seeds. We're continuing to explore ideas for creating synergies between SRI and green remediation. SRI also offers an SRI university, hopefully several times a year, and what makes this special is the hands-on, in-depth training provided to new reuse coordinators, RPMs, and CICs. And these trainings include roundtable discussions on regional fees, reuse planning, site-wide RAU success stories, contractual concepts, and attorney perspectives on reuse. We're also trying to bring trainings to interested regions each year. Next slide.
Slide 14.
The goal of the Return to Use Initiative is to remove barriers to reuse that are not necessary for the protection of human health, the environment, or the remedy at sites where remedies are already in place. Next slide.
Slide 15.
The Return to Use Initiative is currently one of our primary efforts. It's focused on construction-complete sites or sites that are partly cleaned up. And this initiative has one major purpose, to remove barriers to reuse that are not necessary for the protection of human health, the environment, or the remedy at those sites where remedies are already in place. And as part of the initiative, we capture the lessons learned at the site and create demonstration projects so other cleaned-up sites can benefit from the experiences. We also make an effort to do what we can to address the barriers and work with the regions to figure out ways headquarters could potentially help on a site-by-site basis. So some examples are providing regional seed resources, identifying and sharing examples that promote lessons learned, and helping regions draft ready for reuse determinations. This year, SRI is going to issue a fact sheet to remedial project managers talking more about the initiative, how SRI can help, and what makes a good demonstration project. Next slide.
Slide 16.
As I mentioned, in March 2010, the Land Use Directive, considering reasonably anticipated future land use and reducing barriers to reuse at EPA lead Superfund remedial sites, was finalized and released. We're currently assembling a short training module that will share highlights from the directive, and we'll be looking for opportunities to share this module through webinars, regional training, and other events. Next slide.
Slide 17.
So if you have any questions or if there's anything I mentioned in this brief introduction that you'd like more information about, please don't hesitate to get in touch with me. I'm looking forward to the rest of our webinar, and I hope you will find the information useful.
Great. Thanks, Melissa. At this point, if anyone has any questions for Melissa on her presentation about the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative or anything else that she presented that's related to that, I will open the phones for in the next minute or so. If anyone wants to speak up and ask a question, you can take your phone off mute. If you used our keypad, you can hit #6 to unmute yourself and ask a question, or you can certainly submit a question online. Okay. Well, Melissa will be here for the duration of the webinar, and if you think of any questions, please, you know, submit them at any time using the question mark icon or speak up at one of the other times that we offer a question and answer period. So our next speaker is Bill Denman of Region 4, and he's going to talk about the Spelman site, which is the story of supporting reuse early in the process. And we are on slide 18. So, Bill, it's all you.
Thank you, Michelle. As Michelle said, my name is Bill Denman. I'm a remedial project manager in Region 4. I'm also the Superfund redevelopment coordinator. I happen to be the remedial project manager for the former Spelman engineering site as well, so it's one that I'm very familiar with. And the former Spelman site illustrates how early remedy and reuse discussions can provide opportunities to develop partnerships, tools, and agreements that enable successful site cleanup and redevelopment. In Orlando, we worked with the City of Orlando, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, and a local school to address remedy and reuse issues from the very beginning, and it's continued to be a consideration throughout the implementation of the remedy. Next slide, please. So in this presentation, I'm going to go over the site background, the parties, the goals of each party, what are some of our key project components were, what the benefits of this process were, and some of the lessons that we've learned. It was a very complicated process, and so I'm going to go through some things quickly, but if you have any questions or if I go over anything that you don't understand, please submit a question at the end, and I'll be glad to clarify it. Next slide.
We're on slide 20.
So just to get an orientation for any of you that are familiar with the city of Orlando, looking at this map on the left-hand side is Interstate 4, which kind of runs north and south at this particular point. Then there's a major road that crosses it, the East-West Expressway. And north of the East-West Expressway and close to Interstate 4 is where most of the center of downtown Orlando is. It's where Church Street is, the high-rises, the city government building, City Hall, things like that. And so where the star is, as you can see, kind of in the upper center is the former Spelman Engineering site. And so even though it's in a mixed residential and commercial industrial area, it's very near to downtown and therefore makes it a very attractive piece of property. Next slide.
Slide 21.
So now I'm going to focus in on the actual facility, and if you see the little orange square there, that's the actual former Spelman Engineering facility, and then the green area to the west is property that's owned or was owned by the city and the Orlando Utilities Commission, which is the water and electric part of the city, and had some historical operations from the OUC that occurred there. Through an investigation in what was going on at OUC, they actually found the contamination that came from the former Spelman Engineering project, and so I'll get into that a little bit more in a minute. But around the site, you have some small businesses kind of to the north and to the west, the little buildings that you see, and then as you go south and east, it's more of a residential area. It's about a 25-acre piece of property that we are going to focus on. The area is also addressed by the Lake Highland Land Use Plan, which is a development plan that was adopted by the city with extensive community input in August of 2000. The plan and accompanying zoning outlines a mix of expanded residential, commercial, and recreational land uses in the area. Existing infrastructure is available to help support new land uses. So you have a lot of community involvement here as far as what types of uses would be acceptable to the residents here. And so as we move through this process, the community was very involved. Next slide.
Slide 22.
A little bit about the history of the former Spelman Engineering operation. They operated from approximately 1963 to 1969, and they used trichloroethylene, TCE, which of course is was a common degreasing solvent in the manufacture of components for the space industry. TCE that was discharged at the site contaminated the groundwater and generally flowed toward the lake. So in addition to the operation at former Spelman Engineering, as we said, the Orlando Utilities Commission had some operations there, and through an investigation there, which really didn't turn up to find very much, the TCE from the Spelman facility was located. Next slide.
23.
As I said, it's about a 25-acre property, and the figure that you see here is generally the extent of contamination. As you can tell, it started at the Spelman Engineering property, and Florida, as you all know, is flat and it's very sandy, and so typically the groundwater and therefore the contamination flows toward the water bodies. And so in this situation, most of the contamination flowed kind of to the south and west toward the lake at the bottom of the figure, which is Lake Highland. Some of it flowed directly west to Lake Ivanhoe, and then there was a small component that kind of pulled north to Lake Formosa. The total area of the contaminant plume was about 40 acres. You have residential areas to the northeast and southeast, and again, the commercial areas that we talked about. The area is also addressed by the Lake Highland Land Use Plan, which was a development plan that was adopted by the city that I talked about before. So it's important to remember that as we go through this discussion. Next slide.
24.
I guess the key findings that we found in our investigation was that no actual human exposure was occurring. There was migration of the contamination to the groundwater that threatened the municipal supply for the city of Orlando, and that's what prompted our involvement, and that the Lake Highland property that's above would be suitable for remediation. So there was a strong preference indicated by the city of Orlando and the local community to use a third-party approach and try to leverage the value of this property that was owned by the city and the Orlando Utilities Commission and use that money to help fund the cleanup and therefore keep the property off the national priorities list. And so from the very beginning, the city of Orlando came in, conducted a lot of the work, the remedial investigation and feasibility study through a memorandum of agreement with us, even though, again, you know, even though the property was owned by the city and there had been some operations there, they were not the source of the contamination that's being addressed. And so therefore they're not a liable party, but there was a strong preference from the city and the community to keep the site off the national priorities list. So they wanted us to consider this third party cleanup approach. In addition, it was expected that the cleanup could be reached faster because we wouldn't have to compete for funding and potentially be delayed in the funding of it. The record of decision for the site was signed in September of 2004, immediately after we started the remedial design. Again, we were able to go through that process and really had to have some resolution before we started the remedial action because the site has to be on the national priorities list for us to use fund money to do a cleanup. So by that point, we had to have these issues resolved. Next slide.
Round 25.
So this slide is kind of shows the more recent extent of contamination and kind of a conceptual remediation plan. Again, you can see from the different colored figures, the red and the orange are the higher level contaminant levels of TCE, and the ones that are further out, of course, are lower level. So the primary remedy focused on the areas where the highest level is. The remedy on the facility itself will be electrical resistance heating, and then just to the north of the site, there'll be a small area that will be treated with in situ chemical oxidation. And then as you move south and to the west towards Lake Highland, we are using a bioremediation, enhanced bioremediation process through injection wells. And that'll be important in a minute. So pay attention to the area where the orange circle is that is moving towards Lake Highland. And if you look, Lake Highland is the lake at the bottom of the figure. If you look just south of the lake, there's an area there that is in a blue dashed line. That is the Lake Highland Preparatory School, which is a private school in Orlando. And you can kind of see their football field out in the front of the school there. And if you look just to the north of the lake, you see a baseball field there. And so that was an area that the school was leasing from the city. Before any of this happened, they were leasing from the city and using for their ball fields. And so, as you can see, the school didn't really have any room to grow their recreational facilities, and so it moved across Lake Highland and leased this portion, about 6 acres from the city, and built this tennis courts and the baseball diamond that you see. Next slide.
Slide 26.
So, As we said, since the initial investigation, we've been working with the City of Orlando and the community and the Lake Highland Preparatory School, and so I'm going to go over some of the goals of each party. Of course, it's our job as EPA to protect human health and the environment. We do that traditionally through listing sites on the national priorities list, and that gives us access to remedial action funding to conduct cleanup in a situation like this where there is no responsible party or there's a defunct responsible party. The City of Orlando, of course, was involved. They owned part of the property that the contamination had migrated under. They had that property that was worth a lot of money because of its location that could be sold to potential buyers. Their priority was to get the site cleaned up without it being listed on the MPO, which was not just the city, but it was the community's desire as well. And of course, the city and EPA wanted to ensure that the site was redeveloped consistent with the planned development that had been approved in the neighborhood and community. And of course, the taxable value generated by the redevelopment would help replenish some of the money that the city, would spend on the cleanup. Next slide.
Slide 27.
Of course, from the neighborhood perspective, this property is or was an eyesore because this was undeveloped property that the OUC owned. They kept it mowed, but there had been some old buildings there that were torn down, and it wasn't really in keeping with the area and as far as the aesthetics. And so they had been complaining for several years that something should be done with this property. And of course, you know, they worked very hard to develop this development plan that limited the type of redevelopment that could occur. Now, the Lake Highland Preparatory School, they were interested in the sports complex that they had already built on this property that the city had leased them. They had an option to purchase this property, and so they had already invested a good bit of money building tennis courts and a baseball field. They needed additional recreational space, and they had an option to purchase. So, and they're right in the center of the property, so that certainly affected what type of development could occur surrounding the recreational facility. So they also need additional parking because there's not a lot of parking at the school, so just for regular school day parking, people park on the north side of the lake and then walk or shuttled to the school. So that was kind of a catalyst that kind of formed what type of redevelopment would be appropriate there, even though the planned development developed by the neighborhood allowed for some residential condominium townhome type development. I think as long as the height of the condominiums wasn't above, I think, four floors. So they did not want another high rise there in their neighborhood, and I think that was the primary concern of the community, is that a high rise would go in and affect their feel of their community. Next slide.
28.
So there are a lot of key project components. It was a very complicated project. Initially, we had a third party that wanted to come in and purchase the property, or the property except for what the school owned, take on the liability, conduct a cleanup, and then sell it to a vertical developer who would develop in keeping with the planned development. But this all happened about the time the real estate market went south. In the late 2007-2008, and so we're kind of back to the drawing board, and the city of Orlando stepped up and said, well, we're still interested in doing this, and so we want to work with the school and see if they're interested in buying the property. So again, you have the joint resolution. The joint resolution was a different component, where the city of Orlando and Orlando Utilities Commission got together to see who would take the lead, and the city was appointed as the lead agent for the city's and for the sale of the property, and that was a big step, because there was some argument between the city and the Orlando Utilities Commission as to exactly who owned the property and who would get the proceeds from the sale. And it was important, of course, for the city to get it, because the city needed that to fund part of the cleanup. A series of related agreements followed in 2007 and 2008, and EPA issued a contiguous property owner agreement, which was the first of its kind issued in the nation. In this contiguous property owner agreement, the city agreed to implement the site's remedy, which is estimated at about $12.9 million. It included a covenant not to sue, and we waived EPA's oversight costs. So this agreement stemmed from the liability protection that the city actually had through the Brownfield amendments that were passed in 2002, which set up the bona fide prospective purchaser provision, but also set up the contiguous property owner provision, which provides a similar liability protection. And so we were entering into an agreement with a contiguous property owner who's not a liable party or has the defense, because they're a contiguous property owner, to conduct the cleanup. And so this was the first document of agreement of this type in the country, and we're hoping can be used as an example at other sites. At the same time, the city of Orlando negotiated an agreement with the Lake Highland Preparatory School to develop a sales and purchase agreement for 18 of the 25 acres that the city owned that you saw north of Lake Highland. So the school bought all but 7 acres of that property. And so the city is currently deciding what to do with the other 7 acres, but Since then, the school has gone in and redeveloped a lot of the 25 acres into additional recreational facilities, which we'll see in just a minute. The Lake Highland Preparatory School worked with EPA and FDEP on two agreements, the first of which was a bona fide prospective purchaser agreement, which the school needed because their charter prevented them from buying contaminated property. So I believe they wound up creating a separate entity to purchase and own the property, and so needed a covenant not to sue to ensure that that the school wouldn't be held liable for the cleanup. And they entered into a brownfield site rehabilitation agreement, since the site is not an MPL site, with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, so that it can be cleaned up under BISRA, which also gives them some liability protection and access to some of the incentives that go along with the BISRA. With the sale and purchase agreement, the BFPP and BISRA agreements finalized, the site's cleanup moved forward in accordance with the ROD. We modified the ROD in 2010 with an ESD, which added the electrical resistance heating component to the site, which is going to be on the actual site facility property, because when we were doing some investigation prior to cleanup, it was originally going to all be addressed with in situ chemical oxidation, but as we did additional investigation, we found some DNAPL, or dense non-aqueous phase liquid, and it was determined by Arcadis, who is conducting the cleanup, that would be a more, they proposed that as a more appropriate cleanup method to use, and it's important that they proposed it because they're cleaning up the site under a guaranteed remediation program, which I'll talk about in just a second. But basically, they came to the city and sold an agreement to the city where for a fixed price, which was the $12.9 million, they would address the contamination down to where natural attenuation would address the remaining low-level contamination. So this is a fixed price for Arcadis, yet they came in and said, look, we really need to use electrical resistance heating to address this higher-level contamination on the site. And frequently people say that electrical resistance heating is way too expensive to consider, but in this particular case, even though it was a fixed price for them, they felt like it was the situation at the site was appropriate for that, and it was well suited and would definitely be worth the extra money spent on the implementation. Next slide.
Slide 29.
So, again, we have the City of Orlando and the Orlando Utilities Commission, which previously owned 25 or so acres of this property. They sold all but seven. The Lake Highland Preparatory School, which had formerly leased about 6 acres and built the sports complex that we saw on the overhead, they now own 18 acres and they expanded their recreational facility. And Arcadis, who is the contractor that's conducting the cleanup for the city, that is, again, conducting it under this guaranteed cleanup program, or GRIP, which gave the city some certainty as to what the actual cleanup costs were going to be. Next slide.
Slide 30.
Other agreements. I'm kind of going back through these again just to make sure everybody understands, because it was such a complicated process. We entered into a bona fide prospective purchaser agreement with the school, and the brownfield site rehabilitation agreement FDP entered into, which gave them cleanup liability protection, lender liability protection, and access to some of the voluntary cleanup tax credits, which are transferable. So the city can use those or transfer those to Arcadis or to another entity or actually sell them. So they're a transferable agreement. Obviously, tax credits don't do anything for a city. Next slide.
31.
This picture was taken just a couple of weeks ago. This is pouring the footing for the building that will house the storage facility for the lactate that's being injected as part of the enhanced bioremediation part of the remedy. We kind of start on the outside and are moving in, so we wanted to start with the enhanced bioremediation part of it. And if you turn, so this is the footing again for that building. What's being injected will be stored in this building and then distributed underneath what's now the recreational facility, a new ball field, in pipes and injection wells, which were installed before the ball field was, so that they're actually all underground, so you don't even see them. So if you were looking at this facility and then just turn to the left, you're going to see the figure, you're going to see what's in the next picture. So let's move to the next slide.
532.
And that's the new baseball field that is put in by the school. So underneath that baseball field, you have injection and monitoring points that are buried beneath the field. So there's no, of course, they're GPS in, so Arcadis knows where they're at in case they have to access them for maintenance or anything like that. But the injection of the enhanced bioremediation will occur underneath the field without seeing anything from the surface. And as you can see, you see one high rise in the background there, and just to the left, you see the little point that's a part of the main school at Lake Highland. And if you were to turn just a little more to the left, you see a lot of skyscrapers, which is downtown Orlando. Next slide.
Slide 33.
So as far as our cleanup status, I think I've talked about a good bit of this. Our remedial action work plan was finalized in September of last year. Our enhanced reductive dechlorination began. They should begin injecting next month. And they're estimating about 3 years of that. Beginning in July, we will begin with a small part of the in situ chemical oxidation that's still needed. We're going to do we're expecting two injection events for that. And then the electrical resistive heating construction should begin in December of 2012, December of 2011, and then begin operation in January of 2012. We're installing some permanent monitoring wells on the very outer part of the contaminant plume to have some permanent points where we can monitor the extent of contamination. And EPA is installing those. We just finished on Tuesday with the first phase of that, and we'll be doing a second phase of that in a few months. Next slide.
Slide 34.
As far as the redevelopment, that's the front gate to the sports complex. Again, they expanded it, and there was a rush to get the piping in for the injection wells and monitoring wells, because there was a strong desire on the school to be able to start practicing baseball in January. And I was there 2 weeks ago. They're already playing baseball games on the field, so it's already in use. They plan maybe for some additional school facilities, some additional enhanced parking, and again, the city is exploring options for the 7-acre area that they have remaining on it. Just, I didn't even go into this, but just to further complicate things, there's there was a rail spur that ran just through the middle of the property, and there's actually a small cleanup going on as part of the cleanup of this rail spur, which ran from downtown Orlando a few miles out to, I think, what used to be an Army training facility. And that spur is planned to be turned into a rails-to-trail trail. And so when the school redeveloped their property, they wanted to use, you know, this area, and so they rerouted, or they deeded an easement around the edge of their property that's as wide as the railroad easement that will be the rail trail part now. So if the rail trail is completed, it'll come to the school and then kind of just make a little circle around it and then be back on the railroad right away. Next slide.
Slide 35.
As far as the benefits of this, it did expedite the cleanup some. There was a time period when that was being questioned, mainly because of the decline in property values, and we had the third party that was involved back out, so we kind of had to start over again with our negotiations with the city. But I think all in all, it did expedite the cleanup. It saved the Superfund about $12.9 million while still ensuring the protection of human health and the environment. It helped improve the aesthetics of the community. Now you have a ball field and all there instead of old parking lots and footings for old buildings. It was a good example of a public-private partnership for redevelopment. And the new land uses not only meet the community's needs and priorities, but also meet the priorities for the Lake Highland Preparatory School. It increased the taxable value, and it should provide a long-term catalyst for redevelopment in the Lake Highland area. Next slide.
Slide 36.
As far as our lessons learned, I guess the most important lessons learned was communication was the key to the success. Communicating early and often with our local government, community, state, and federal partners. Towards the end of this project, we wound up having a weekly conference call between representatives from the school, the city, the state, and us with EPA and their associated consultants, attorneys, to work through the many issues we had to work through to get all these agreements in place. Also, engaging with our headquarters and the Department of Justice was important. We did that early on, our attorney did, and therefore, you know, had them involved in the process and on board for necessary reviews and approval, so this wasn't just something that hit them new that they may have significant comments on. I think identifying opportunities for the stakeholders' leadership on the various parts of the cleanup was important. Of course, the city wanted to be involved, and so we identified, well, these are the kind of things you could do. I think because of our early engagement, we enabled communities to access some of the assistance through the Brownfields program, and that was coordinating with FDEP and their Brownfields coordinator. I think just being able to consider different options that people brought up and not just say, well, no, that's not how we normally do it, was important in being able to adapt to different approaches and ways of doing things. And, you know, I'd say the lessons learned is, you know, it's long and winding the journey was, but it was worth it. I mean, it's really nice to go and see the cleanup implementation almost to begin and see the area redeveloped into a recreational facility and being used by the kids of the school there. Next slide.
We're on slide 37, which I guess is the start of Franz. Do you have any other things you want to say, Bill, before we open it to questions?
No, I'm ready to answer questions.
Okay, great. So we'll spend a couple minutes going through some questions and Bill can answer. So if you have any, please hit the question mark icon and submit them online. We have a question that came in from Queenie in the Underground Storage Tanks program here at EPA, and she was hoping that you could re-explain the advantage of the contiguous property owner agreement.
Sure, I'll be glad to. In order for the City of Orlando to conduct this work for us, it had to be conducted under an agreement. We had to have a certainty that the cleanup would actually happen, and the city needed to have certainty that because they came in and started conducting cleanup work that they wouldn't all of a sudden become a responsible party. And so what the contiguous property owner agreement did is it acted similar to a consent decree, but it laid out that the city would conduct the cleanup. They would implement the remedy specified in the ROD. They would achieve the cleanup goals no matter what. I mean, they're on the hook for achieving the cleanup goals. And from the city's perspective, that EPA, we gave them a covenant not to sue, that if they conducted this work consistent with the statement of work that was attached and consistent with the ROD, that we would give them a covenant not to sue, so we would not sue them as a responsible party. And in that, we agreed to give up our oversight cost, which we would normally bill to a responsible party, in exchange for their cooperation, in exchange for their voluntarily stepping up to conduct the cleanup. So the contiguous property owner agreement was the document that laid out all of these, and we entered into it. Again, you know, it was an agreement between the U.S. government and the City of Orlando. So it kind of served the same purpose as a consent decree, but also gave some assurances to the city as well.
Okay, great. Thanks, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I'd like to open up to the folks on the telephone. If you have a question, you can speak up at this time. Take your phone off mute. If you use the keypad, you can hit pound 6 to unmute yourself. So if anyone on the phone has a question, now's the time. Okay. Well, we're going to move on to the next presentation. So if you think of any questions that you have for Bill or Melissa or Fran during the next two presentations, but, you know, like I said, hit the question mark icon and put a question online, and we'll have another couple of opportunities for the people on the phone to speak up if you think of something. So thanks, Bill, for your presentation. That was very interesting. Now we're going to move on to Fran Castanzi, who is an RPM in Region 8, and she's going to talk about the Midvale site, which is an example of how working with communities to discuss the reuse pre-ROD and how writing the ROD in a flexible manner to allow for those reuses had some great outcomes. So, Fran?
Hi, everyone. As Michelle said, my name is Fran Castanzi. I work here in the Denver office of EPA, and I'm also the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator. I was the RPM on the Midvale Flag site for 7 years, including during the time we're going to be talking about. And I need to apologize in advance. I'm unfortunately getting over a cold, and my voice doesn't sound right yet, so I do feel much better than I sound. So I hope you can hear me okay. We're going to be starting on slide 37. And at the Midvale Flag site, we're going to talk about how we consider reuse and how it can be incorporated into different stages of the pipeline, basically from pre-ROD through design and construction. At the Midvale Flag site, EPA worked collaboratively with stakeholders to determine both the site remedy and the future reuse. There were four primary stakeholders in addition to EPA, and they were the state, the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, Midvale City, the property owner, and the remaining responsible party, which was a small family-owned company named Littleson Incorporated, and also a citizens group called Citizens for a Safe Future for Midvale. EPA worked with the stakeholders and used key site documents, including a reuse assessment, reuse master plan, and a ready for reuse determination to support the site's reuse. Midvale City leveraged partnerships and resources to prepare the site for development, and EPA and Midvale City worked with the other stakeholders to develop an institutional control management system to ensure the successful long-term stewardship of the site's remedy. So beginning back in 1999, these parties worked together on a coordinated approach that linked the cleanup and redevelopment with the protective remedy and a land reuse as the overarching goals. Moving on to slide 38, what we're going to be covering today is a little bit about the site background, the parties and the goals, key project components, project benefits, and also lessons learned. And you'll see quickly that it's not possible to talk about the Midvale Flag Superfund site without talking about the site next door, Sharon Steele. I'll go into the location a little bit more in a couple of slides, but on the slide you see in front of you on 38, the Midvale Flag site is in orange, and the adjacent Sharon Steele site's in purple. Slide 39. Some of the great things about the site as it relates to redevelopment is its location. It's only minutes from downtown Salt Lake, about 12 miles from the airport. It's adjacent to major highways and interstates. There's a rail line that goes through the site, and it's also in the scenic Jordan River watershed, which is the main river in the Salt Lake Valley. And you can see it in the photo there, kind of running along the left-hand side of the picture frame. So, slide 40, please. The Sharon Steele and Midvale Flag sites were placed on the Superfund National Priorities List in the early 1990s after many years of discussion and controversy about the listings. essentially, with the listings of the sites, we had Superfund sites that had over 700 acres that were empty and unproductive for many years until just recently. These two properties had once been the livelihood of much of that part of the Salt Lake Valley and certainly Midvale City. As I mentioned, the sites go together. They were once part of one large facility. Early on, there were a variety of different smelters in the area, but gradually it became one conglomerated facility. So from 1871 until 1958, there were smelting activities happening at the sites. Eventually, the mill, the processing yard, got constructed over on what is now called the Sharon Steel site. In 1958, the smelter ceased operations, but the mill continued working with another smelter in the Salt Lake Valley. It closed in 1971. Starting in the early 80s, when the listing discussions started happening, we started finding heavy metal contamination in the soil and groundwater, and also in the surrounding community. And eventually, in 1991, the Midvale Slag site was listed. Sharon Steel was actually listed in 1990. The Sharon Steel site work proceeded more rapidly than at the Midvale Slag site. And by the way, Midvale Slag was named because of these huge black piles of slag that towered over most of the property. So under the Sharon Steel site work, many of the residential yards in Midvale near the smelter were cleaned up, which involved surface soil excavation, backfilling, and revegetating the yards. The mill buildings on Sharon Steel were demolished, and which ended up being critical, the large pile of tailings from the mill were capped with an impermeable cap. At first, the community in Midvale City had hoped that the tailings would just be hauled away, but it eventually became clear that that was cost prohibitive and also impractical. There were about 170 acres of tailings. So what the city and the community wanted was they wanted the remedy to be constructed in such a way so the property could be reused. EPA and the state of Utah's most concern was to have a protective remedy, and this was relatively earlier on in the Superfund process, in the years of Superfund. So what happened is there was a large impermeable cap built. Most of the responsible parties for the sites were settled out, most of the operational parties, and the money was put into two special accounts, one for each site, to help assist with cleanup activities. It's important to note that almost 20% of Midvale City's boundaries are in the two Superfund sites. Almost all the undeveloped land in the city was in these two sites. All that Midvale City really had left to develop besides these two sites were some small inholdings. So Midvale City staff made it very clear how important it was for them to be able to redevelop the sites, especially the Midvale Slag site, which was now going through an RFS. Excuse me, moving on to slide 41. Here's another picture of the map we looked at earlier. You can see the orange Midvale Slag site, the purple Sharon Steel site. You can see the two interstates that cross nearby, Interstate 15 and 215. And the Jordan River is the blue area that follows the green dotted line along the western boundary of the two sites. Most of Midvale City is located to the east or right on your screen. Operable Unit 1, which was mostly buffer land, was approximately 266 acres, and the former smelter property itself was Operable Unit 2. Slide 42. So the key parties and goals. We heard very clearly that what the community and the city wanted was a different approach from the Sharon Steel cleanup. And we wanted to find a way to do that. We heard their concerns, and the city did an exemplary job of reaching out and talking to us and trying to explain why they needed it to be different, as did the citizens group, Citizen for a City Future for Midvale. So we weren't quite sure how to proceed, but we saw this as an opportunity to try to do something different. EPA ended up awarding a redevelopment pilot, one of the ones that Melissa talked about earlier, to Midvale City in late 1999 to show them that we cared about finding a way to reuse the site and also to give them some means to do it, as it was a $100,000 grant. The pilot, the city actually worked with EPA and the other stakeholders to develop a detailed estimate of the community priorities, local economic conditions, regional market trends, as well as being able to work with us as we were conducting our remedial investigation feasibility study at the site. They were then able to help us bring to the table and understand the reasonably anticipated future land uses for the site that would help address community priorities and fit with the site's, and so we could work with that to fit with the site's remedy. They ended up calling this the Bingham Junction Master Plan, which ultimately Midvale City Council adopted in August 2000. And this outlined opportunities for basically a mixed-use site, residential, office, retail, and recreational use. So by late 2000, we had that information to go on, but there were a lot of uncertainties. Basically, it was still unclear how we would take this information and work together, especially along with the outstanding enforcement issues, to make the future a reality. Slide 43. There are key project components. One was, that we'll talk about in future slides, updating outdated approaches, phasing site cleanup activities, some innovations in the decision documents, issues with cleanup funding and enforcement, institutional controls and long-term stewardship, and also a ready-for-reuse determination. Slide 44, please. Updating outdated approaches. So by the time we'd given the city the redevelopment, the reuse pilot, the ROD for the Record of Decision for Operable Unit 1 had already been written. It basically assumed that there would only be heavy industrial uses allowed in Operable Unit 1. Remember, this was the buffer land, and it had a soil cover with institutional controls and groundwater monitoring. In 1998, again, before the reuse pilot happened, that remedy had been modified to allow some limited excavation and ICs. What we ultimately ended up doing in 2006, after we had a decision for the other operable unit, was we modified the original record of decision for operable unit 1 to change the land use restrictions, allow multiple uses, deal with the riparian area along the Jordan River in the same way as we were dealing on the other operable unit, and have a comprehensive groundwater monitoring plan for the whole site. It's getting a little ahead of myself, but what we're ultimately able to do is bring what had happened previously on Operable Unit 1 around so it matched with what we ended up doing on the other Operable Unit. Moving on to slide 45. Here's some pictures of the site and the big slag piles and what it looked like before cleanup. You can see in the bottom picture the Union Pacific Railroad, which passed through the site, and the railroad trestle there. And those piles that you see are all piles of slag, which turns out to be relatively low-level contamination, but, as you can see, high-volume wastes. So we took additional field investigations on the southern portion of the site, Operable Unit 2, And we ended up doing this in the context of the reuse work that was going on with the city's lead under their redevelopment pilot. So we were trying to look at what various redevelopment scenarios could be allowed at the site that would be protective and also be able to be reused. We ended up in the record of decision that came after this delineating essentially four categories of smelter waste. We found out that there was a category one, which is very highly contaminated, but there was only a very small amount of it. And we just named it category one to help explain it to the public. It has no legislative meaning. Most of the waste was category three and four. Category four were the huge slag piles. Category three was also relatively lightly contaminated waste. During this time, we worked very closely with all the stakeholders, actually had them review our draft work plans, had them review our draft reports, so everyone was very much involved, had their sleeves rolled up, and could understand and follow what we were actually coming out with and how we might use that information. The citizens group was given a technical assistance grant by EPA, so they had a technical advisor that could help them understand the information that was being collected and presented. This helped us develop realistic community expectations of what could be possible, not only for the cleanup, but also for reuse of the site. It also let the city of Midvale use that information to rezone the site based on the information in the Bingham Junction plan and the information we were collecting in the RIFS process, so that would help guide the city's future redevelopment. Moving on to slide 46, one of the things we did, because it appeared for these 180 acres we were looking at multiple uses, is we tried to lay out in the decision document what would be allowed on the different parts of the site based on what the final area would be. So if we had a soil cover, what kind of use would be allowed on top of that? So, for example, you wouldn't want someone to put a single-family home in a garden, but a building footprint or a parking lot would be just fine. And this is laid out in a table in the record of decision that allows for different uses and corresponding institutional controls based on that type of use. We knew that we couldn't decide at the record of decision stage all of the different possible uses at the site and exactly what would go where. So we tried to develop a system that had the flexibility for different types of uses and then different types of barriers between that and the contamination and the different types of controls that were needed. So this slide just shows a brief portion of the table that's in the record of decision. Moving on to slide 48. After we were able to have a record of decision, we then moved on to actually how we would do the cleanup and implementation. One of the biggest issues at the site was the concerns by many people at EPA that there would be a windfall lien, that somehow the property owner would benefit greatly from the economic development at the site. And that actually took quite a while to straighten out and was quite controversial, as this was one of the first times we had encountered it and EPA didn't have a large track record with it. It was clear that any development at the site would, in addition to the Superfund cleanup, require millions of dollars because of the lack of infrastructure at the site. Even so, in the ultimate consent decree that we did, Littleton Incorporated agreed to put a percentage of their net development proceeds up to a cap of $22 million to the government as the site got developed. And eventually, they were able to do that. Another option that we talked about and worked out that was innovative was how the cleanup would get done by the responsible party. you need to understand that Littleton Incorporated was a small family-owned company that had purchased the land after the smelter had been demolished, but before Superfund. They found themselves in the unenviable position of being called a Superfund potentially responsible party, but they had never operated the site and were, as I said, a small family company with not much assets except for owning the property. So we were able to work out a innovative approach where Littleton Incorporated would do the cleanup under the consent decree to the terms of the record of decision, so meeting EPA's terms for what was a protective cleanup. But they did it in such a way where they would do a portion of the work that we outlined in the consent decree that had milestones, and upon successfully completion of the milestones, which were defined in the work, they would get reimbursed from the site's special account for what that work would take place. Excuse me. Sorry about that. My voice is going. So let me give you an example. It was necessary to take a lot of debris off the site, used equipment, junk, clearing and grubbing debris, and we had outlined as a part of the design documents what would be involved and when that part would be considered successful. When Littleton Incorporated's contractor completed that portion of the work, they got a set amount of dollars that we had negotiated beforehand and is in the consent decree, and they got that reimbursed from the special account to them that let them go and do further portions of the work. There was no way that this small family-owned company could have done this cleanup without this kind of setup. And frankly, it was in the government's interest to let Littleton do the cleanup. They were able to do it less expensively than we could. They had negotiated a fixed-price contract with their contractor to do the work. And at the same time, they could integrate into the cleanup things that we couldn't do under Superfund, such as they could integrate redevelopment components, like putting in utility corridors, that we would have not been allowed to spend Superfund dollars on. So while we reimbursed them for the Superfund part of the work, they were able to spend money on the non-Superfund part of the work, like utility corridors, and get more done, where we would have had to go in as the government, do the whole Superfund cleanup, and then someone else, a potential developer, would have had to go in and put in things like utility corridors after the cleanup was done. There was a huge cost savings in doing it integratedly, in an integrated fashion. So also in the agreement, we wrote into the consent decree about that certain protections, including the bona fide prospective purchaser protections, and also a covenant not to sue for future site owners, which meant that they would not be liable under Superfund for their activities at the site, assuming they exercised due care, which was outlined in the consent decree. Future site owners would also have to comply with the site's institutional controls, allow access for groundwater monitoring and other operation and maintenance. And one other interesting component is that Middell City itself signed on to the consent decree. So they were a party, they were able to participate in all negotiations, and they are also in there as implementing the institutional controls for the site, which we'll talk about. And also, they frankly could be enforced against if they fail to comply with the institutional controls and do them and implement them appropriately. The state was also a full party in the negotiations, but chose not to be a signatory to the consent decree. And lastly, the consent decree settled out the relatively minor responsible party remaining at the site, and that was Union Pacific, which had the rail line passing through the site. As a part of this whole process, moving on to slide 48, we developed an institutional control process plan for both the northern and the southern operable units, OU1 and OU2. It had soil and waste handling and disposal controls, meaning if you were going to excavate into the soil and the slag at the site, you had to have worker health and safety. You had to either put that material back in the hole when you were done or dispose of it off-site appropriately. There were mortar management and groundwater use controls, requirements for permitted site uses. So there's controls over not having such things as gardens on the site. There's also vapor mitigation controls, because even though there was no volatile plume at the site, there happens to be a PCE plume coming from off-site and passing through the site. So we had to include vapor mitigation controls as a part of the site standards. To implement all of this, the City of Midvale developed an institutional control ordinance that's managed out of their offices. And one of the things we did was we were actually able to use special account dollars to fund them through a cooperative agreement to hire someone to actually oversee the institutional controls. That person, Ray Lim, is currently the site's development coordinator, and he works with everyone from prospective developers out there through the ongoing construction and the ongoing oversight of institutional controls, helping people answer their questions. Excuse me again. Slide 49. You can actually go and read the institutional control ordinance for Midvale City, which lays out all these ICs. We worked really hard at developing institutional controls that would fit into the city's processes, that wouldn't be strange animals, so to speak, for their staff, that would fit into their planning and review process, and also something that their public works staff and their planning and zoning staffs could understand with help from Ray Lim, the IC coordinator. Slide 50, please. So here's pictures of some of the work going along the Jordan River. The design and implementation, as I mentioned, helped with locating infrastructure such as utility lines. We actually had a protective remedy that would help support reuse at the site and, important for EPA and the state, minimize operation and maintenance. The flag was be able to be used throughout the site, both for fill in the areas as the site was regraded, and also for road base. Conditions were enhanced for the site. Redevelopment could be phased over this, frankly, huge site, 446 acres. We also have long-term cleanup. Groundwater monitoring continues. We were able to work with the city and the developers and the property owners to locate groundwater monitoring wells and move them as needed. Moving on to slide 51. In August 2006, Midvale City hosted a river cutting ceremony, and there was an issuance of the ready for reuse determination and the site's availability for redevelopment. Smelter cleanup was done, and basically the land was ready to be reused. The only part of the cleanup that wasn't done was the short strip along the Jordan River, and that is actually going to be finished later this year. It's almost done, but it didn't stop the redevelopment, as that was basically an 18-foot strip along the river. Following the issuance of the Ready for Reuse determination, which helped give comfort and understanding to people about what needed to get done out there, the Gardner Company and another partner, Arbor Commercial, approached Midvale City in 2007, and they were able to work with the city to figure out how to develop the remaining portion of the site. So So by 2008, a lot of development activities were happening across the site. If you move to slide 52, this is an example of, instead of black flag piles, what much of the site looks like today. There's still some areas that are undergoing development, but essentially there's currently 750 people working on the site, and it's growing all the time. Last year there was $1.4 million in annual tax revenues, increase in site property value. There are everything from low-income housing. There's HUD homes on a portion of the site. There's also several developments of luxury condos. There's a supermarket on the site with various restaurants going up around it right now. There are, there's a corporate center at the site, including FL Schmidt's U.S. headquarters. So they brought high-paying engineering jobs to this site in two LEED Platinum buildings. If you move to slide 53, the bottom picture is some of the housing that's now at the site that people are living in. And the top right is the FL Schmidt building, the LEED Platinum building, where there are high-paying jobs at the site. In August of this year, the Utah Transit Authority is opening a rail commuter station on the site. It's already built, and the opening ceremony will be in August, and that will help with more jobs, more transit-oriented development around that area. And as I mentioned, the area along the river, the cleanup, including a river walk which connects it to other communities, will be completed this year also. Lessons learned. What we needed in the beginning was for all the major stakeholders to sit down and listen to each other. It hadn't happened really well at the Sharon Steel site for a variety of reasons, but everyone was committed to spending the time and actually approaching the site in an interest-based approach, hearing what the other party's concerns were, and working very hard to figure out a way through those concerns and how to respond to them. EPA really needed to engage the community. That may be an overused term now, but we really needed to make the site work. And it was very important and critical to the site's success that local government decided it had to play a strong role and actually committed the staff and time to do that. Integration of how the remedy and the reuse work together and how they might be able to enable the cleanup to go forward and reuse was an important component. The fact that the site was located in an area near the interstates, near where there was demand, also significantly helped. One of the things that I didn't spend a lot of time going into was, as a part of the institution control process, we put a clear process together for what a potential developer would have to do. If you can reduce the uncertainties for developers coming forward, you can really make that land more attractive to them. If they're going to have to worry about government agencies going back and trying to figure out what to do or decide what to do, they're going to go to a different property. But if you can make it clear and straightforward, understandable, it lowers their anxiety level and, frankly, makes them want to choose that area. And I can't say enough about the importance of integrating and really thinking through how the whole institutional control process is going to work with site cleanup and development. You can't stick ICs on at the end. It has to be integrated in and thought through so that they actually work, and at the end they do what they're supposed to do and you continue to have a protective remedy over time. That's the end of my presentation.
Okay, great. Thanks, Fran.
You're welcome.
Yeah, we've gotten a few questions submitted online while you were talking, so I think we'll start with those.
Okay.
The first question, could you describe to us the remedy that they used at the Sharon Steel site and why the community wanted a different approach for Midvale?
Sure. The hardest part of the Sharon Steel site was the mill had processed the ore and produced this huge mountain of tailings, a sand-like substance with contamination, mostly lead and arsenic contamination. And what EPA and the state had done is they had gone and built this beautiful impermeable cap. At the time it was built, it was probably the largest in the country. At least that's what I hear. And it had many layers, you know, drainage layer, impermeable layer, that you could not actually, you weren't supposed to pierce. And it had some pretty severe slopes with different benching. Essentially, it was a lovely cap, but we might as well have put a sign up saying, stay away. Mm. And it caused a lot of concerns about, well, what could you do up there? Could you put utility corridors? Could you put foundations? How could you go about doing that? And we're actually working on that now. That's another story. But because that wasn't considered as a part of the cleanup, what our approach at the time was basically, well, we'll clean it up and then we'll figure that other stuff out later. It ended up with it being very difficult to do.
Okay.
So we heard that very clearly when we were going through the work at Midvale SAG, and we spent a lot of time thinking about things such as, did we actually need an impermeable cap? It turned out we didn't for the material, which was different over on the Midvale SAG side of the street.
Mm-hmm.
And how would we handle those utility corridors? And would people be allowed to excavate, and how would that be allowed to happen? So that all helped us inform and do it differently at Midvale SAG.
Right. Well, that kind of leads into another question that came in, as wanting to know about what the nature of the impervious cap was. Was it HDPE or clay? And then what provisions were made to allow installation of utilities? Did the ICs address this? What about planting trees? Basically, if someone wanted to dig on the site, are they able to call into a one-call system to find out what they need to do to comply with the ICs?
Okay, so a couple things there.
Yeah.
I'll try to summarize it quickly. There is an impermeable cap that you have difficulty piercing over at the Sharon Steel side. There is not at the Midvale SAG side, so I'll focus the rest of the answers on Midvale SAG. What we did there is we put the most contaminated waste, we laid that out first over the ground at the site. Then we covered it with the low-level contaminated slag, and then there's clean fill on top of that. You are allowed to dig down into that area, and we do know, because we did this all as a part of the cleanup, we know how deep the different areas are in the different parts of the site. And also the slag, which is black, sort of serves as a witness area, too. Not only do you have the actual measurements of when you're going to get down into it, but you can see when you're going to hit the slag before you get the more contaminated area. We were lucky in that most of the material at the site isn't very leachable, so we don't have a lot of groundwater contamination, and that wasn't a concern, so we didn't need an impermeable cap to prevent it. So you can have trees. There are trees. You can actually dig into the area complying with the controls that are in the city's ordinance. So we don't want workers to be exposed. We want to make sure the material is handled, put back into that hole. So if you're digging footings or utility corridors, you can excavate the material, you stockpile it to the side, and you put it back in the hole, or you have to send it off-site to a permitted facility. And that's all outlined, and that's part of what Ray Lim, the city's coordinator, does when he works with developers, outlining all that and explaining it. And now it's pretty much down to a science. It doesn't take a lot of extra work or thought. It's easy to follow. Did
okay,
I
great.
Answer all those questions?
I think so.
Okay.
Quite a few questions coming in, but in the nature of time, we do have one more presentation. Bill Demon's going to talk about another site that he worked on. And Fran needs to rest her voice. So I think what we'll do at this point, I'm going to ask anyone who's on the telephone, if you have a question you would like to ask, we're going to give you a minute here to speak up. So you're welcome to take your phones off mute and ask a question if you're on the phone. Okay. So it doesn't seem there's any questions on the phone. So in the essence of time and to get through our last presentation, I think what we'll do is we'll move on to Bill Denman's second presentation on the Pepper Steel site. And then after Bill's finished, we will return to the question and answer period, and we will address the questions that are coming in online here. So please continue to submit them as Bill is presenting his next presentation. So, Bill?
Thank you, Michelle. The next site I'm going to present on is the Pepper Steel and Alloy site, which is a site in just west of Miami in Miami-Dade County. This is an example of how reuse considerations can be considered in a post-construction completion site or a site that's in long-term stewardship, and not only how it can be, but the consequences of not addressing institutional controls or reuse considerations, what effect that can have on not considering it when you enter a long-term O&M. Next slide. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the site background, the site status before redevelopment, its O&M, the IC status, and of what was going on with the property, and then how reuse affected the status of the property and how it enhanced both long-term O&M and institutional controls, and what lessons we learned from that. Next slide.
We're on slide 57.
So the Pepper Steel and Alloy site is a 25-acre site. It's in, again, as I said, it's in western Miami-Dade County, Florida, just west of Miami. It was formerly occupied by a variety of industrial enterprises, including a battery manufacturer, a heavy equipment repair, and automobile and power transformer scrap metal operations. These businesses operated for about 20 years from the mid-60s until the early 80s, and as a result, the soil became contaminated with oil that was contaminated with PCBs as well as heavy metals. And this contamination threatened the Biscayne Aquifer, which is a sole source drinking water supply for that area. That area gets most of its drinking water, if not all of its drinking water, from the Biscayne Aquifer. And it starts basically just below the surface, and there's not really a confining layer or anything that prevents or can inhibit contaminants from getting in. So it's very easily affected. So in 1984, we listed the site on the NPL. Next slide.
Slide 58.
So just to fast forward into the remediation, it was performed by one PRP, which was Florida Power and Light, in a bifurcated settlement which separated the O&M responsibilities to the remaining PRPs, which were the landowners. There were three property parcels associated with this, so there were three landowners that were also PRPs, but we settled with Florida Power and Light to conduct the remediation and then settled with the remaining landowners for O&M. The remediation consisted of excavating and disposing off-site of the most highly contaminated soils. Then the remaining lesser contaminated soils were excavated, solidified, and placed in a monolith that was about 11 acres, extended over three of the property parcels. Again, we'll see those on the map in just a minute, but the monolith was about 11 acres and covered all three property parcels, and it's about 5 to 6 feet above the surrounding grade at its center line, which is important because that area is very flat and it's barely above sea level to begin with, so this probably doubled its height above sea level and created some stormwater issues, but on the other hand makes it attractive because it's much less prone to flood. All remediation, when the monolith was created, it was covered with crushed lime rock, and all that was completed in 1989. So it was a site that was conducted years ago, long before we started really considering future use in the implementation of our remedies. Next slide.
Slide 59.
So you can't really see it very well on this figure, but it's right on the Miami Canal, and you can see the figure that covers the three property parcels is the monolith, and the top parcel we'll refer to as the Curtis parcel. The middle one is the Payne parcel, and then the smaller one at the bottom is the Bloom parcel. So as is typical, and we run into these issues a lot of times with considering redevelopment at Superfund sites, we consider the site one one piece of property, but in many instances, like in this, it's actually three separate property parcels. Next slide.
Slide 60.
So this is a picture of the monolith covered in crushed lime rock, just so you get a kind of an idea of what it looks like. Next slide.
61.
So the O&M plan, which outlined what the O&M should be, was completed in 1989. It called for maintenance of the cover, maintenance of the drainage collar, because this monolith, the water didn't percolate through, and it drained off, and so there was a drainage collar created, which was basically an infiltration trench that allowed water to run off, collect in there, and then infiltrate into the groundwater. There were security fences that were needed to be upkept, access roads, and monitoring wells that we used to evaluate the effectiveness of the monolith. However, the plan was not implemented because of lack of funds. Again, as we said, the separate settlement was ongoing with the landowners, and it wasn't completed until 1997. And part of the money that was settled with the landowners was put into a special account for O&M. Next slide.
Slide 62.
So there were some institutional controls in place on the property. After the remediation was complete, there was a 1983 covenant which restricted the bloom parcel, which was the bottom parcel, and there were some restrictions on the septic system. There was a 1985 agreement which restricted wastewater creation and storage for the Curtis parcel, and then a rod and consent decree. The rod and consent decree contained general language for restrictions on future land and groundwater use, but they weren't specific. As you can see, these ICs were clearly not strong enough to maintain the protectiveness of the remedy in the long term. Next slide.
Slide 63.
Again, the property remains divided into these three parcels, and this is just to reorient you with those three parcels. Next slide.
Slide 64.
So from 1989 to 2002, the monolith was fenced. It was vacant. There wasn't really any operations and maintenance that occurred. The ICs obviously weren't very strong, and the site pretty much fell into disrepair. It was not used. It was subject to extensive dumping of debris, and it became overgrown with vegetation. The most visible result of this lack of maintenance was the growth of an 11-acre Australian pine forest on the monolith, and by the time of the 2002 five-year review, some of these Australian pines, which those of you who are familiar with South Florida know, these things grow, they're invasives, and they grow really fast. Some of them had attained heights of over 30 feet. This forest was growing right on top of the monolith, and it could have greatly impacted the protectiveness of the remedy in the long term. Fortunately, they don't have really strong root systems, but one of the things it also did is they really grew in the drainage collar, because that's where all the water went, and so they wound up plugging up the drainage collar, and as a result, when it would rain, it would frequently flood adjacent parcels and adjacent properties, so there were a lot of complaints about flooding when it would rain. Next slide.
Slide 65.
So this shows some of the abandoned structures and debris that was dumped on the property. By the way, the debris is now in the process of being sorted and removed by the new owner. That picture was taken in 2007, so some of it had already been removed. Next slide.
Slide 66.
So this is some additional debris. As the fence got torn down, it cost a lot of money to dispose of these things properly, and so people were just dumping stuff on it, including like these big concrete parts that you see there. Next slide.
Slide 67.
Just a photo of some of the vegetation that grew in the drainage collar. It wasn't properly maintained, and so as the root system from the vegetation, and this I think is after some of it had actually been cleaned out, was contributing to the flooding of the adjacent parcels. Next slide.
568.
So by 2002, we conducted another five-year review, and it really triggered a lot of changes. There was a strong national program emphasis at that time on five-year reviews as sites began to mature and get into this post-construction type of O&M, and we were starting to identify situations like this where if proper O&M wasn't conducted, the impact that it could have. So the O&M plan was partially implemented. We cleared the trees off. The settlement from the property owners, the partial settlement, put money into a special account that we could use for conducting some of the O&M. And as the property was cleared off, it started, and people started asking around the area, you know, can we build on this property? Can we use this property? We'd like to buy it. We'd like to do something with it. That's when we started entering into conversations with people about potentially reusing these three parcels. We also revisited the institutional controls. In 2004, a deed notice attached the consent decree as it's to put restrictions on the Bloom parcel. And a separate restrictive covenant in 2004 restricted the Curtis parcel more, and that IC runs with the land. So in 2005, reuse of the property began. All three of the parcels are currently in use. This reuse continues to evolve, and we're actually working with the property owners to implement stronger institutional controls and on what the future reuse might be to try to marry our post-construction activities with potential redevelopment. Next slide.
Slide 69.
So this is a picture of one of the parcels. This is the one in the middle that was sold. This person makes precast concrete, mainly for stormwater components. You see a couple in front there, and so he basically mixes these concrete pieces in a form and then stores them. The footers for this structure were designed to spread horizontally so they could start 6 inches above the monolith. And the floor of the building is about 2 feet above the monolith. And of course, this even enhances the cover of the monolith above the crushed lime rock that was there. Next slide.
Slide 70.
At the time of the 2007 five-year review, there was a business that stored empty land sea containers that you see here on the western part of the Payne parcel. This person would purchase damaged land sea containers and store them here and then take them to his facility and refurbish them and sell them. But this was really just a storage place for him when he would buy them. They have since moved out. For whatever reason, and the current property owner has taken advantage of that opportunity to start the extension of a road which extends down the western edge of the three property parcels. And this is the person who has the precast concrete business is funding this. So he's paid for the design, permitting, and implementation of preliminary drainage improvements and backfill of subsurface road material. He'll pay for the final road surface work, which will help bound the monolith and protect and enhance the implementation of stormwater controls. This is currently on hold due to the economic downturn, but he feels that this the improved road surface that they've done so far will help enhance the sublease opportunities that he may have for the western portion of the property, so anticipate it starting back up soon. By continuing to work with the owner, the reuse on this portion has evolved into something more protective and has enhanced the long-term benefits regarding the stormwater, which really, you know, wasn't an intended advantage of having someone reuse the property, but just by having someone there and someone that has a self-interest in the property being reused and being able to sublease it out has actually enhanced the area, not just for our site, but for the surrounding property owners that to help address some of the stormwater issues. Because it's so flat and so close to sea level, when they have heavy rains, storm flooding is a real concern there. Next slide.
Slide 71.
So the Bloom parcel, which is the furthest parcel south, there's a three-truck parking storage service which you see there in the picture. Next slide.
Slide 72.
And by addressing some of the issues, we feel it's helped spur nearby redevelopment. This is an adjacent parcel, which is north of the site. This isn't part of the site, but it's been redeveloped independently of our activities, and similar type buildings are being evaluated for portions of the Pepper Steel property. So we see redevelopment occurring in the area, and not only do we have an obligation to ensure that these sites are properly maintained, but by getting someone on the property and getting them into productive reuse, it can really help spur redevelopment on adjacent parcels. Next slide.
Slide 73.
So just to kind of summarize some efforts that support O&M, the new site owners and users are taking steps to improve O&M. One big issue has been the destruction and non-functionality of the drainage collar. The current owners are working on a drainage system that will be even better than what was implemented in the remedy because it will have to satisfy current stormwater ordinances for the entire property parcel, not just the monolith. New berms and the repair of existing stormwater drains have already been implemented in the parking lot to promote drainage and prevent flooding of the nearby road. The debris from years of illegal dumping is being sorted and removed. This supplemental cleanup has been occurring for years and is continuing with the construction of the new road. Current owners and users are also working with EPA to implement institutional controls that will ensure the protection of human health and the environment while allowing for appropriate uses. The standardized covenant currently being designed for the site will add an additional layer of institutional control protection to the site. Mr. Lista, who's the former owner of the former Payne parcel and the owner of the former Bloom parcel, are responsible for maintaining their bona fide prospective purchaser status to avoid inheriting Superfund liability. And one of these criteria is that they cooperate with EPA staff as far as putting notices and restrictions on the property. The RPM for the site, which this isn't one of the sites that I manage, but the RPM stated that all the site's current property owners have been very amenable to the idea of having a standardized covenant and have been willing to work with EPA on the language and have agreed to put it on their property deeds as soon as it's completed. Therefore, having these site owners interested in putting the site back into productive use has facilitated EPA's ability to ensure that institutional controls are in place for the site. Next slide. So while constructing the new road, the property owner was required to install 4 new monitoring wells and a stormwater drain by the county, which you see the stormwater drain in the picture here. They provided us the information on these new wells, and we plan to use those for data, or we plan to use the data collected in it in our next 5-year review. Next slide. One of the things we've done is we've been putting in flush-mounted wells instead of stick-ups when repairing wells to help support the reuse of the sites and ensure no future damage takes place. That's one of the things we can do as they redevelop the site. Next slide. Oh, and we the wells that were pictured there were abandoned and moved to a low-traffic area, and we have, you know, some limited O&M funds available to do that that's in the special account. Next slide. Sorry,
we're on slide 76. We're on 76?
Yes, okay. Yes, I'm sorry. So throughout the years, we recognized that some of the monitoring wells weren't giving the best results. Some of them weren't put in the best places. So recently, we've been improving our data collection by moving some of the wells, and it actually also helps enhance redevelopment, because we're moving them more to the corners of the property and kind of gets them out of the way, but it also is in a better location for monitoring the effectiveness of the monolith. As we move the wells, as I said, special care is taken to place them out of moving vehicles and other traveled pathways, and then we flush mount them to prevent them from being an obstacle in the future. Next slide, 77. So as we illustrated in the case study, the greater the effort put into post-construction completion activities, the better and more consistent long-term stewardship you're going to see. In addition, site reuse contributes greatly to ensuring the good long-term stewardship. It's kind of like a neighborhood watch model where the current landowner has a vested interest in providing oversight of day-to-day activities and protecting the integrity of the property and therefore the integrity of the implemented remedy. Of course, this is important to them because they're required to do this to maintain their bona fide prospective purchaser defense to provide reasonable care to avoid being considered a PRP. And I guess, you know, it's also ensure that it's important to remember that even if it's not specifically planned for or wasn't envisioned in the ROD, maybe it was like this site, an older site that was listed in the 80s, that reuse is possible. And not only is it possible, but we should also think about it when we get to those what we call post-construction completion sites or long-term O&M sites. Next slide.
Slide 78.
So here's some additional examples of reuse in Region 4. The top example, website there will take you to a description of the Solatron microwave site, which is in Port Salerno, Florida, which is about an hour north of West Palm Beach. That's a site where we had a 20-acre parcel with an old abandoned building in it, and a developer purchased it and created a kind of a commercial office park. And the building you see there on the right is the first building that was built on it. She separated out the site into seven different parcels and has sold three of those parcels to date. And so instead of having an eyesore and an attractive nuisance to the community, there was a lot of illegal activities that took place in the old abandoned building. It was really falling into disrepair, and there's a lot of graffiti and vagrants and drug deals and things like that. Now they have this attractive commercial park that's also brought jobs to the community and has enhanced the tax roll for that property. Then we have an example on the bottom, which is the Beulah Landfill, which is near Pensacola. And at the Beulah Landfill, after a number of discussions with the stakeholders about potential uses, the Northwest Florida Modelers Academy of Model Aeronautics Club negotiated an agreement with Escambia County to use the site for flying their model airplanes. So today, the northern part of the Beulah Landfill, which is also known as Spritz Field, is a successful model airplane park that has received high praise from the local news media. It was recently written up in the Pensacola paper. According to the terms of use, money generated from the use of the site can't be used for individual profit, but must be invested in the site improvements, which helps ensure continued maintenance of the site. We have a lot of sites in our region and throughout the country where the Academy of Model Aeronautics works with us to fly model airplanes, and they've been a very successful partner with EPA. We help them identify these areas that they can fly their model airplanes, and they've been very good stewards of it, and so we're very proud of that. Next slide.
Slide 79, that's your contact information.
That's the end of my presentation, so I guess we'll...
Okay, great.
We've got about 5 minutes for questions, is that right, Michelle?
We have a little bit more than 5 minutes, and we can also stay on a little bit longer if you and Fran are available.
Okay.
We don't get cut off right at 4 o'clock. So, one thing I want to state, if you folks advance to slide 80, you'll find the slide that I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation where you can find links to additional resources and also a link to a feedback form that you can complete to let us know what you thought about today's session and what you'd like to see in future sessions. So, perhaps while we have Bill and Fran answer some questions, you could be filling in that form, or when we end, you could quickly fill that out for us. We'd appreciate it. I think first, we have a number of questions that have come in online, but I think what I'll do first is see if there's anyone on the phone line that wants to speak up with a question. So if you're on the phone, you can unmute and ask a question. You can hit #6 if you used your keypad, and that will unmute you. Okay. Appears that most people are submitting questions online, which we like because they're ready to go. So where should I start? There's lots of things that came in. I guess maybe I'll start with this question at the bottom because we've got a number of questions about institutional controls. So we got a question from Matt in Region 7 wanting to know about who's responsible for enforcing ICs? And I know Bill and Fran, you both talked about that in your presentation, but is there anything that you can add to that?
Well, usually when we put institutional controls on property, it's usually done pursuant to whatever the state land law is or whatever their processes are. So typically, you know, it's consistent with whatever the state process is. So in Florida, You know, in this particular case, you know, this will be on the property deed, and therefore the state, or maybe in this case Miami-Dade County, sometimes does the enforcement of those kind of things. So it would either be the state or the county.
And I agree, though, you know, I would remind people that institutional controls are there because they're part of the Superfund remedy. We, for whatever reasons, didn't clean up the site to the buzzwords unlimited use, unrestricted exposure. So we had to have some controls added for the remedy to be protective. So ultimately, you know, when we're doing five-year reviews or at some other time, if we find out that they're not being enforced, the danger is that the remedy isn't protective anymore. So even though different parties, as Bill said, may actually be responsible for doing the oversight and enforcement or the day-to-day work, ultimately it comes back to, is your remedy out there still protective? And then that comes back to EPA.
Okay. There's another question that came in related to ICs wanting to know about the water management and groundwater use controls and where they agreed to. Did the site have to clean the groundwater to MCLs? And was the point of exposure agreed to different from the unit boundary or the point of compliance? I'm not sure exactly which site this questioner is referring to, so go ahead, Bill.
Well, if it's the site in Florida, this was the Biscayne Aquifer is the sole source drinking water aquifer. So I apologize, it's not my site, so I'm not 100% familiar with the ROD, which was also written in 1988. But we always clean up in a situation like this. We would have to clean up to MCLs because the Biscayne Aquifer is the drinking water source for that area. As far as any water management or groundwater use controls, until the MCLs are reached, then there would be a restriction on the water use. I'm not, again, I apologize. The RPM for this site is on vacation this week and wasn't able to sit in, and he would know more about that. But there was no there's no point of compliance issue here. The whole site must meet MCLs. The reason we have monitoring wells is to collect data to ensure that nothing's leaching out of the monolith. So it's more for the reason we have wells around the edges of the monolith is to ensure that nothing's coming out of the solidified material and getting into the groundwater.
Okay. Fran, we got a question that came in while you were talking about Midvale, wanting to know about the types of institutional controls at the residential areas.
Yes. Mostly they have to do not with, mostly they had to do with how things would get built out. There are some single family homes going in now in certain areas of the site, but most of the site are condos or apartments. And so most of the controls had to do with how the utilities would get put in, how the footers would get put in. There aren't a lot of large land areas. And you can actually read about them if you want. If you go to the Region 8 website of EPA, we have a link going to the City of Midvale's ordinances. So if you want to actually see how they're written and what's there, you can go read about it in specifics yourself. If there was a certain question someone was getting to that I, in my general answer, didn't answer.
Okay, great. I guess another question that came in about Midvale, wanting to know who were the parties to the consent decree?
Okay, the parties were the property owner, Littleson, EPA, Midvale City, and the Union Pacific Railroad.
Okay. And while we're talking about Midvale, I might as well go to the last question I have up here. And it was Todd from Region 7 wants to know what happened to the piles of slag material. And how does the current topography compare to the previous site conditions?
Good question. So this was a part of the Jordan River Valley, and it had been a meandering river before it was channelized in the 70s. So part of the site was up on river bluffs, and the other part was down in the floodplain. And there was a pretty sharp drop-off of the cliffs. And what happened is now it's more of a sloping area the slag and the contamination, except for the most contaminated, the category 1 waste, everything else is still there under the layers of soil. So the most contaminated is very deep underneath. And then there's slag, which is sometimes many feet thick, because there was a lot of slag. And then there's the cover soil. Then there's the structures or roads or parking lots or whatever. So it's all still there. You just can't see it anymore. And it's the main issue was dermal contact. And actually, you know, if you were eating it or inhaling it, luckily the material we were dealing with wasn't highly leachable, so we were able to do the cleanup in this way.
Okay. So, Bill, there's a couple of questions here that came in after you spoke about the Spelman site. The first question I'll give to you is from Kyle from Florida. And he has a question about chlorinated solvents and at what point the federal government steps in. He says that there are numerous sites contaminated with chlorinated solvents, namely dry cleaners. Why did the EPA decide to put this site on their Superfund list? I remember you saying at the beginning it was the beginning to threaten the city's well field, and was this the major qualifier? What depths, there's a number of questions here, what depths were the solvents found? Since the active remediation hasn't actually started yet, what is the city doing to protect its water supply, and are they no longer pulling water in the area of contamination?
Well, I guess to start with the issue of when EPA gets involved with the cleanup of chlorinated solvents, EPA has a process for evaluating sites to see whether or not they qualify to be in the Superfund program. It's called the HRS system, and Kyle, I see that you're with DEP in West Palm. You can talk to Paul Wiersbicki about that. I know he's very familiar with it. Or you could also talk with some of your colleagues in Tallahassee. We have an agreement with the state of Florida where they evaluate sites, and we call it site assessment. And then they go out and look for sites, and then recommend sites to us, and they go through an objective process to see if they meet the requirements to be placed on the Superfund list. And then at this situation, like at Spelman, it qualified, and we were in the process of placing it on the NPL, and that's when the city stepped in and said, hang on, we don't really want this on the NPL, and neither does the community. What can we do? How can we work with you guys to avoid this? And so that's kind of the process for that. The city's well field is very, very deep, much deeper than the contamination. It's hundreds of feet deep where they pull their water there. And the contamination mainly is in the, I would say, 15 to 80-foot range. So even though it's moving towards the well field, it has not actually impacted any well field yet. And that's one of the findings that we found in the RIs, that nobody was being exposed, but it does threaten the city's well field, and of course, you know, we sample to make sure that it's not in there. I think this, obviously the city samples its water supply wells frequently, and they're so much deeper than this contamination, it's never shown up there. So they're not really having a effect as far as pulling water towards the contamination or pulling the contamination toward the well. The three water bodies in the area have more of an impact on the direction of the flow of the contamination.
Great. Okay, and Bill, there's one more question that came in after Spelman from John in Ohio. He wants to know about what's the depth of the contaminant plume and what is the depth of the DNAPL that's being addressed by electrical resistance.
Talked about the depth of the contaminant plume, but on site we have a semi-confining layer. I want to say, I can't remember exactly the depth, I want to say around 30 feet, maybe 32 feet, and the water table is maybe around 8 feet, and so the DNAPL, which we had looked for DNAPL before, we had high levels of contamination, but we never really found DNAPL, and we found it in the investigation we were doing as far in the design part of the remedy, and we had been doing a lot of rotosonic type work around in very nearby. And so what we think happened is by vibrating the subsurface there, it caused the DNAPL to collect in one of our monitoring wells. When we pulled it out, we actually got DNAPL, and then we weren't able to find it again, but you know, the contaminant levels are so high we suspect that it's there. And so one of the reasons Arcadis wanted us to consider adding electrical resistance heating to the remedy was that our situation here is so good. I mean, we have a somewhat of a confining layer at the site that provides us a bottom. We have a sandy vadose zone that allows the volatiles to permeate up in after the subsurface is heated, and it'll be pretty easy to pull them off. So there's a lot of site-specific conditions that really lend itself to electrical resistance heating at this particular site, but we're relatively shallow.
Great. Okay, well, we seem to have answered all the questions that have come in online. I think I'd like to turn it over to Melissa to see if she has any closing remarks she'd like to make.
Okay, thanks, Michelle. I want to thank Fran and Bill for giving us a really good overview of the kind of guidance or our thinking process, if you will, of how we think about sites, how we think about reuse throughout the pipeline, including or especially even post-rod. So we started with an introduction about Superfund redevelopment, and then we heard from Bill about the Spelman site, which supported reuse early in the process, and it was also not listed on the NPL. And then we heard from Fran about the Middale Slag site, which is a great example of how working with communities to discuss reuse pre-rod and writing the rod in a flexible manner to allow for those reuses can have great outcomes. Also, Middale is a great example of how people manage ICs very creatively. And if there's more information on that, I think Fran said you could go to the Region 8 website. And then finally, we heard from Bill again about Pepper Steel, a site where reuse didn't enter the picture until after construction completion, and how EPA was able to work with interested parties to make reuse not only happen in a protective way, but in a way that enhanced the long-term protection of the site. So again, I want to thank our panelists. I want to thank the people who for listening to the webinar, and there's plenty more information, which Michelle went over before. Mm-hmm. So thank you all.
Yeah. Yeah, so thank you, everyone, for your participation. And please fill out the feedback form, because we do read them and take your thoughts into consideration in planning future webinars. So thank you all, and enjoy the rest of your day.